Welcome to More Than Meets the Ear, a podcast of the George MacDonald Society. So today, in our first inaugural podcast, we have some exciting guests. We have with us today Amanda Vernon and Kirsten Jeffrey Johnson, who have kindly come over to my house to do this opening podcast together. Very briefly, since all of us are new to this, my name is Danny Gabelman. I'm the academic rep for the George MacDonald Society, and my interest in MacDonald is primarily with his fairy tales and fantasy, but very generally. And could you tell us, Amanda, a little bit about your interest and your background in MacDonald?
Yeah, absolutely. So I did a PhD on MacDonald, and I was focusing on his work as a literary scholar, a literary critic, and looking at how his theology and his approach to reading and interpreting and lecturing on literature interacted. And specifically, I was interested in his understanding of literary form. So how he kind of understands different forms like poetry or drama as operating and kind of performing a theological function.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. And we have also with us today the co-chair of the George MacDonald Society, Kirsten Jeffrey Johnson, who is probably a little bit more well-known than either myself or Amanda in the George MacDonald world, but would you also give us a little bit of background on your interest in MacDonald?
Oh, thanks, Danny. Like both of you, I also did my PhD on MacDonald, which for me was a culmination of really a lifetime of loving reading MacDonald stories as a child. I was about 6 years old when I was first introduced to MacDonald stories, and returned to him again later in my 20s with a more academic viewpoint. And I think one of the things I was really interested, I was struck by how MacDonald stories had actually shaped the lives of other people I knew. And I had become aware of that myself, and was struck by how many other people I met who would say that their career choice was shaped by MacDonald, or how they were as a father was shaped by MacDonald, or the relationship with God was shaped by MacDonald, and always through his stories. And so I was interested in this concept of how story can shape and change a person, and how we are changed through story, and indeed the correlation with scripture on that, that there's a sense of the gospel is a story and that's what changes people. And interested in that, interested in, was this intentional on MacDonald's part to write stories that shaped people and could change people? And in my reading and wondering about that, I kept on coming across Lewis and Chesterton, Auden, by inference, Tolkien, talking about MacDonald being a mythopoeic writer. And indeed, Lewis calls him the greatest mythopoeic writer. And he calls mythopoesis the greatest of all the arts. So then I became curious about, what do they mean by mythopoeic writer? Does that just mean writing something that is kind of Middle Earthy? Or no, actually, when they're using the term, it clearly means more than writing fantasy. And so what is this greatest of all the arts? And are they right in applying it to MacDonald and in calling MacDonald one of the greatest of these arts? So that's what my thesis became, was delving into, what do they mean by mythopoesis? And if indeed MacDonald's intentionally using story to shape people's lives, how did he become somebody who made that choice? And how does he come to value story so much and see story as a transformative means?
Excellent. Thank you. So what we were hoping to do is maybe sort of join together our interests and our specialties and to have a conversation on some of these points. And I think one of the things that we've discovered, having some conversations before this recording, is just how much we're passionate about exploring MacDonald's multiple modes and his different ranges of things that he did and was capable of doing. And of course, he's most well known for things like his sermons and for his fairy tales and his fantasies. But in addition, and maybe even in one sense more primary than that, was his role as a educator and as a teacher and as a person who was very conscious of literature and the power of literature. So as Kirsten was saying, the power of story to transform And as Amanda was talking about these different modes and genres in which he was operating, but also thinking about the genres and commenting upon them. So we thought we'd focus our conversation on MacDonald as a teacher of English literature, as a critic of English literature, to think about that a little bit, because he was in many ways one of the earliest critics, certainly of what we would think of today as literary criticism. Obviously there's lots of forerunners and predecessors to MacDonald in this line. Amanda, what would you say in terms of what was MacDonald's place within this early, young, growing field of literary criticism in the middle of the 19th century?
Well, he was certainly an incredibly popular lecturer. So he actually spent the majority of his career, especially up until just a few years before he passed away, before he had a stroke, and then a few years after that he passed away, lecturing on to thousands of people sometimes on Shakespeare and Dante and Tennyson's poetry and Wordsworth, you know, all sorts of different texts. So he was incredibly popular, I think that would be one thing to say. But at the same time, he was very well respected by other critics of his day. John Ruskin and he were good friends, and Ruskin wrote him a letter saying that he would prefer for him to, if he had a son, he would prefer that he took his lessons in literature from MacDonald than anyone else, because of MacDonald's love for the topic, and because he was less concerned with, you know, his own opinions on things, or essentially hearing the sound of his own voice, than he was with appreciating the art, the good art that he was reading and lecturing on. So I think he was very much kind of bridging, you know, the academic worlds. I mean, at this point, you know, as you said, literature was sort of just literature as a field of literary study was very much just beginning.
And maybe just a follow-up then, because we think about the critic, and obviously we think about words of being critical, and there's a association of being harsh and also being very judgmental and these kinds of things. How does that fit? If you know, because we do want to be careful how we're talking about MacDonald as a critic, and what exactly he would have thought by, well, would he have even used that word critic? And if not, what would he have used? How would he have thought about it? How would he have thought of his role in relationship to literature and education?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a really good distinction, because I think that perhaps there was less of that distinction then than there is now, between a kind of critical, distant analysis, almost like you can look at a text and stand away from it and analyze it, which I think we often associate with academic literary criticism now, where you're sort of, you almost come to it with an attitude of suspicion, or kind of trying to find what's going, you know, to pull it apart. And this, you know, almost a more, probably the reason most people who do literary criticism got into it in the first place, which is that they loved reading. And that kind of idea that maybe we, you know, we enjoyed reading and we were immersed in books, and then somehow we learned how to read critically, and we can't do that anymore. We don't enjoy doing that anymore. So I think that is a little bit of the distinction, kind of popular reading, which is fun, and then, or enjoyable, or kind of forms you in some way, and then critical reading. And so I don't think that MacDonald, he didn't see a distinction like that. He's very interested in doing proper scholarly work on a text. So going and looking at, you know, the etymology of words, or looking at, you know, the form, so like the meter and the all of those kinds of, you know, aspects of reading. But at the same time, he was very concerned that it, you know, affected you spiritually in some way. It affected you as a person. It helped you look at the world differently. It helped you maybe want to be a better person, or desire something good. It helped you love the people around you better, depending on what you were reading. And there was a, you know, there's a way in which you were building a relationship with the writer of the text, and coming back to the book or the poem over and over again in order to get more from it, like extended conversations. So he wouldn't have seen that distinction, and I think generally that there was a lot less of a distinction between a kind of critical, in the sense of you know, a kind of negative association with that word, and reading in order to kind of benefit and grow from it.
Indeed, MacDonald even uses the word friendship, right? That is possible to have a friendship with the author of a text. And he says it's not the same as a friendship with somebody who's there with you, because you can't hear back from them on all issues. You actually might, as you read further, find their answer back to your questions. And, you know, beautifully, he, like his mentors, talks about the eschatological nature or potential of a friendship with an author, that maybe someday you might actually meet that author in the life beyond. But there is a sense of it's a friendship.
Yes.
And indeed, when you think, I might meet that person again someday, then how you critique their work becomes different, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that generosity of spirit is a huge part of it. Reminded me, as you were talking, what he says in what I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is his first critical essay on Browning's Christmas Eve.
It is,
Where he says, surely if a man would help his fellow man, he could do so far more effectually by exhibiting truth than exposing error, by unveiling beauty than by a critical dissection of deformity. So there's this idea of criticism not as a tearing down, but as a kind of almost celebrating or praising or revealing the beauty that's already there. Kind of maybe the image that sort of just sprung to my mind was the one of in Fantasties, of sort of stripping away all the stuff from the statue to sort of reveal the form of the thing that's there. There's that kind of aspect to it. Maybe Kirsten, where do you think that came from, that sort of generosity of spirit towards these authors? You know, I think it's, we hear so much in literary studies of the anxiety of influence and the sort of the desire to sort of tear down your predecessors in order to sort of create your own space. You know, and the Romantics did this. They sort of bashed the generation before them. And most poetic generation, you know, the modernists did it to the Victorians, and postmodernists did it to the modernists. And it's like everyone's trying to tear down the previous generation. Why was MacDonald different, or where did that sort of impulse come from?
I think had you asked me that question a couple decades before I knew A.J. Scott and F.D. Morris, two of his primary mentors, I would have said certainly the community in which he was raised, and his father was known, we know, in the community for having that generosity of spirit and for loving the pastors with whom he disagreed, and having discussion and modeling that for MacDonald. This I agreed with in the sermon and this I didn't, and having friendships with people in other denominations at a time where that was maybe not normal in their community. So certainly he was raised in a family that seemed to model that generosity of spirit. And you see that in MacDonald's father's letters too, that he really has that. However, two of his primary mentors, Alexander John Scott and Frederick Denison Morris, were the first English literature professors ever. They were part of the creation of the discipline. Sometimes people name Thomas Dale as the first English lit prof. Interestingly, he was the first put into position at University College London, and it was decided he actually wasn't teaching literature. He was just talking about literature as a leisure entertainment, which is not what the administrators of the university decided, because no one else was teaching literature, English literature. They wanted that to begin. Oxford and Cambridge did not do that. And so F.D. Morris becomes the first person who really teaches literature as is intended, making contact with the imaginations of the past, learning from them, engaging with them in the manner that Amanda has described. And then A.J. Scott, his friend, was his successor as the first person to take it on as a full-time job. So A.J. Scott's your first ever full-time English literature professor. But that underscores how young the discipline is too. So MacDonald really was the second generation of literature professors ever. And so this is a new field. What's really interesting is A.J. Scott and F.D. Morris then are amongst your first people who are teaching literary criticism. And often Matthew Arnold kind of gets pulled forth as a name who is the first there, but actually Arnold's 13, 14 years old when these guys are starting to teach literary criticism. And it's really easy as you start to look at what they say about literary criticism to see the influence on MacDonald. So the what Amanda was describing earlier, even what you just read, Danny, when I read this quotation from Morris, when Morris writes that he says, the best kind of literary criticism is that which delights to draw forth the sense and beauty of a book and is able to do so because the heart of the critic is in sympathy with the heart of the writer. So that's a hospitality that you're talking about, that the first people teaching literary criticism are saying to their students, this is what a good literary critic is. Certainly not what I was taught in university, where you're looking for all the faults and problems, etc. Morris also says, and this is Morris's theological angle, is he writes that there's a principle which I wish should always be taken for granted when doing literary criticism. And that is that if we read and interpret carefully in an attitude of cheerfulness and obedience to the Holy Spirit, our work can thrive. But if we are resistant to that obedience, or if we read with pride, ouch for all of us lit majors, or if we read with pride, our work will be inevitably marred. That's such a different attitude to how much most of us are taught to do literary criticism. But it's back to this relationship concept, and that the person who wrote this book is a human, is a person. There is part of a person there. And why are we engaging with the text? To show all, you know, show off ourselves, all the problems that we have, or to say, wow, this is beautiful and good. I'm going to endeavor, I'm going to put my time into showing others why this is worth reading, as opposed to let me show off all the problems with this. And that's, the former is where the discipline of English literature, that was the foundations of our discipline.
And do you see, I mean, because obviously Arnold's has had a much bigger influence. And of course, there's a sense in which, you know, he talks about the critic in much more in the sort of terms that maybe we would think of as critical and judgmental. I mean, he does go through and, you know, rank poets and sort of say these are in the first rank and these are not in the first rank. And he kind of does a lot of that kind of discernment or judgment kind of things. Why, if this is the origins, is it all Arnold's fault? I mean, what would you? I mean, this all open up to either of you. But why does this not take root as maybe the main method? Is it just sort of against human nature to read in a generous way?
And I would underscore your emphasis on the main method, because I think there have been people who've done that all along. And then I would argue that's clearly what MacDonald does, even within his novels. He's constantly doing hospitable literary criticism, or open, hospitable, yes, but perhaps the main word is invitational. And I think that's what they're doing, is invitational literary criticism. Come and see and taste that it is good. You know, that's their focus. Amanda, the history of literary criticism is more your area. So what do you have thoughts on that?
I think I just would like to go back to what you were saying about, you know, kind of ranking, like Arnold, like MacDonald did that too.
No, absolutely. So, it's not like there's no sense of this is higher quality or lower quality. That's definitely part of it.
But I guess, I mean, I, you know, from what I understand, there is a certain relationship with science at this time as well, and this a kind of almost to, you know, perhaps because of an, perhaps for lots of reasons, perhaps because of an interest in that methodology, perhaps because of certain ideas about truth or what kind of counts as important, you know, various reasons, I'm sure. There was a kind of, you know, especially, for instance, with Shakespeare, there was the new Shakespeare Society that MacDonald was invited to be a part of, actually, at the very beginning. They kind of, the founders, F.J. Furnival and F.G. Flee, were proponents of the scientific criticism, essentially, of Shakespeare. And so they're, in some ways, I think, you know, their approach was to kind of analyze the plays in order to track Shakespeare's development of thought, which MacDonald had a lot of sympathy for, that kind of approach that attempts to see a development in a writer and to try and get at what the author was thinking and what was, you know, influencing him or her and so on. But I think the attempt to sort of maybe pin down or to offer that kind of like a scientific critique that, you know, that would have been where MacDonald would have differed, because he had a lot more of a sense of the text carrying a lot more meaning than might be pinned down like that. So, I don't know if that's...
Yeah, that really helps me actually put some things together in my own brain in regards to Arnold, because Arnold is attempting very much to have a scientific approach to the text, including the biblical text, right? So, yeah. for Arnold, there is only one layer.
Yeah.
There is no Oberglaube. There is no other belief. And so, if you think, like even the mere thinking that this text is now kind of a dead thing, written by dead people, so you have no responsibility to anyone. And when you take that element out, that does change your approach, both to the text and to the author, if you will. Because this is back to what you were talking about, MacDonald's attitude, which is taught to him by Morrison Scott. Both A.J. Scott says that a book is the expression of the living thoughts of living persons. And that we read to make contact with the great imaginations of the past. Again, another quote, Scott paraphrasing John Milton, these books were not absolutely dead things, but the precious lifeblood of master spirits embalmed and treasured to a life beyond life. And I think that can change your attitude if you do see this as a living expression of a living human being, let alone a human being that potentially you may yet engage with someday, then you do approach the text very differently, necessarily. And we know that's something that Arnold struggled with, turned against, left behind, and that's something that MacDonald engages with Arnold over later in their own lives, this difference of approach to the text, whether it be biblical or otherwise.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, you know, if we're going to take Arnold and MacDonald as, you know, two figures that we can look at in the period too, I guess thinking, like you were saying, thinking about the starting point theologically, I think is quite significant. And you know, that's certainly the case for MacDonald, because his entire approach was informed by his theology. I would think, and you can tell me if you agree, that there's sort of like the symbiotic relationship between literature and theology for him.
Or inextricability.
Yeah, exactly. Which includes this idea of hospitality or generosity. And also, not even just that, but the kind of way that language comes into existence, what kind of meaning, what kind of, not just semantic meaning, but spiritual meaning.
And layers and layers.
Exactly.
And that's what Arnold's pushing back. He wants to say there's one clear sense. There isn't layers and layers of meaning.
Yeah.
And these guys are saying, how could there not be? Not only theologically, but if literature is indeed, which they argue, a chorus of voices responding to each other throughout time, of course there's necessarily layers. And for me, I'm sure MacDonald felt the same way. For me, when I was reading through Literature and Dogma, I was feeling sorrow for Arnold, because here's a poet who is arguing there are no multiple layers of meaning. And he's trying to push and say that there isn't, because there has to be this clarity of sense when you read, say, Isaiah. There's got to be one clear meaning. And yet here's somebody who's wired otherwise.
Yeah. And struggling with it throughout his life as well.
Danny, can I just, with, I feel like it would be remiss to, in light of that, and in light of the discussion of relationality and hospitality and friendships, I was incredibly moved in the Beinecke Library when, I don't know, Amanda, if you saw this too, the black-lined letter from Matthew Arnold to George MacDonald. After one of Arnold's children has died, and clearly MacDonald has written a letter consoling him on the death of his child, and Matthew Arnold writing back and saying, you know, thank you so much for your letter. It meant much to both of us, and I'm quite concerned about your writing, your handwriting. I'm quite concerned that your own health isn't good. And I think that's an important part of this dialogue, too, that they disagree deeply on a matter, and yet have their own hospitality towards each other as persons and care for each other as persons.
And even, I mean, and MacDonald in his work, you know, refers to Arnold's work as, you know...
As the the faithful doubters, as one of the faithful doubters, is that the phrase?
Was it associated with him? I think that was associated with Tennyson, wasn't it?
In England's antiphon, there are a few different
he associates different writers there, with it as well.
But he speaks highly of, you know, of his work as, you know, and his knowledge and, you know.
Just because he disagrees.
I agree with you. I think that's very important to, because it's easy, I think, to some extent to sort of pit people against, you know, looking back to be, it's helpful and discussing kind of different schools of thought and different ways of approaching things. But yeah, at the same time, there doesn't seem to have been, you know, there are very few, we were discussing this recently, there are very few people that MacDonald seems to have been really interested in tearing to shreds. he's quite generous generally.
And anybody who he would be interested in tearing to shreds, he probably wouldn't tell us about it, right? I mean, not as...
Right, yes, he wouldn't make it public. That's probably a more accurate thing to say.
There's a sense in which he probably kept it to himself much more. Or it's at least more hinted at rather than directly kind of stated.
Or he'll say, I deeply disagree with Dante in this area.
Yeah, and exactly.
I think Dante is one of
praise him at
writers.
The same time. And doing that sort of disagreeing with Plato on this point, but then saying, but you know, I have to have respect for all of that, everything that Plato does in another sense. And I guess maybe to transition a little bit to maybe some examples, when both of you were sort of talking about this, this aspect, it reminded me of what he says about his own works as in the Fantastic Imagination about how they are living things that he talks about his fairy tales as living things. He always talks about them as butterflies or bees, or you know, and he has that sense of they are living things, and he has that phrase of we spoil countless precious things by intellectual greed. And I think it's that idea of that you're sort of talking about of historical criticism, historical textual criticism, which was coming out of studies of the Bible in Germany and other places at this time, was sort of treating the text kind of like more like dead things. Like this is something that's in front of us that we can do what we want with, in a sense, and treating/mistreating the text in whatever way it seems most appropriate to us. And so he has this idea of his own works as living things. And in that sense, he also doesn't want to control his own works. And that also, I think, gives more space to the reader for interpretation of the works. And I guess kind of what I want to maybe transition a little bit to is what would both of you, maybe starting with Amanda, what kind of reader was MacDonald of other people's works? So maybe Shakespeare in particular might be a good example, since he talks quite a bit about Shakespeare, probably more about Shakespeare than maybe any other writer. What would you say about his readings of Shakespeare? So I mean, if he was, as we're sort of saying, he was a generous, hospitable reader, do you think his readings were good readings?
Were good readings. Yeah, that's a good question. Shakespeare is an interesting one because MacDonald had this, as many Victorians did, a kind of nearly, you know, divine, and Shakespeare was nearly divine in his abilities and not just his abilities, but his character. So there was, for MacDonald, you know, in order for him to kind of read Shakespeare in, you know, what he perceived to be as the most faithful way, you read kind of along the grain of what Shakespeare was doing, right? So Shakespeare for him was able to look at people. The reason he was so good at writing characters was because he was able to look at people and to see the good and see the bad and not, you know, not try and minimize either of those things, but to see also beyond that into this kind of essential humanity he talks about. And so he talks about Shakespeare's great love for humanity and how that enables him to create these incredibly complex characters. And so, for instance, his reading of Hamlet, MacDonald's reading of Hamlet, is very, very much along those lines. So he offers a very generous reading of Hamlet. There were some particular interpretive trends at the time, at least, about, for instance, one of the things was, is Hamlet contemplating suicide, and whether that was actually the case. And predominantly the answer was yes, but MacDonald says no, he wasn't, and he kind of explains why, and then he, you know, Hamlet is a ditherer who was indecisive and, you know, kind of weak because he wasn't making decisions. That's another thing that MacDonald pushes back against and says, no, he's very reasonably he has a lot of new factors to consider. He's seen his father's ghost. His mother's behavior has impacted him in this way, and so he's kind of distrustful of people and unable to make decisions and so on. So in some ways, I appreciate that, and I think he draws out some really interesting aspects of Hamlet. I think he almost does like a psychological reading of Hamlet, which is really interesting. At the same time, I think it can lead to a little bit of a too neat answers in regards to some of the problems that the text presents. So there is, I think, perhaps in relation to his interpretation of Hamlet, a tendency to want to see Hamlet in such a generous way that he does bring out new aspects of the character, but at the same time, or, you know, different aspects of the character than most people were seeing. But at the same time, it can lead him to some conclusions that I'm not sure I'm convinced by, let's put it like that. But I want to emphasize, though, that he wasn't, and particularly the question of whether Hamlet was contemplating suicide, MacDonald actually changed his view on that based on his step-uncle was an expert on Shakespeare. And it kind of, over the course of, I think, many years, essentially convinced MacDonald, and MacDonald, through MacDonald's reading of the text, shifted his position on that. So his step-uncle was in favor of this theory that Hamlet was not contemplating suicide. And so I think that shows that MacDonald is definitely part of the generosity that he exhibits towards a text is an openness to changing. It is huge if he thinks the text is saying something, or if someone's the argument is compelling enough, then he will shift his position.
What about you, Kirsten? What do you think in terms of MacDonald's readings of literary texts? I mean, we don't want to be critical in the negative sense, but is there a sense in which I guess, because part of this, from my perspective, is also when we read MacDonald as MacDonald scholars, and you know, I think part of what he's saying in these essays about his own works, and when he's talking about readers reading his own works, is he's giving readers some freedom and some flexibility. Mm-hmm, so it's not like the critic has to get it right, and I think that's not. Part of it for me is not. You know, I think I do disagree with MacDonald on his reading of Hamlet quite a bit, if I'm honest. But I don't see that as he's necessarily wrong, or he's being unfair to, like, I think he's trying to be extremely generous and faithful to Shakespeare in his own mind and in his own way. But equally, I don't know if he was here today and he, you know, could read some other Shakespeare criticism that's come as a result, he wouldn't change his mind and maybe or maybe allow for another possible reading and say you can have more than one possible reading.
I don't
know what your thoughts are on does he allow for multiple readings, do you think that's a good way of approaching it, or do you think there has to be this sort of
what would
Morris or A.J. Scott say on that?
MacDonald is very much a student of Morris and A.J. Scott on this thought. And those of us familiar with MacDonald, I think it's particularly in The Imagination, Its Culture, and Its Functions, where he discusses how a story or a text can hold within it more meaning even than the author of the text itself conceived. And that, indeed, a text is always more than the sum of its parts, and that he as an author might write something and have no idea of a beautiful thing or an exciting thing or a disturbing thing that's within his text that is there, or that a reader finds there. And it is not just because a reader finds it there and he didn't intend it doesn't mean that it's not there. And he says in one place, really only God can ever know everything that's within a text. And that concept comes from those first English lit teachers, Scott and Morris, who also say the same thing, that a text always is more than the sum of its parts, and that there indeed may lie within a text. In fact, of course, how can there not lie within every text things that the author, truths that the author, of which the author was not even aware when he or she wrote. And I think I want to pull into that. And even with the Shakespeare, I think it helps us understand some of MacDonald's reading of Shakespeare too. Well, all of these literature professors are very keen that, tying back to the relationship, that we know the text comes from a person as well. And so that the more we know about the person, the better insight it gives to us as readers of the text. And indeed may even help us find things within the text that the author never intended or was unaware that they had put into the text. But the more we are in relationship with the author himself, and he writes a whole essay on Shakespeare about this, and if the more we know of the womb of the time into which Shakespeare was born, the better equipped we are to read the text and understand perhaps merely even the meaning of a word that has a different meaning in our day and age, but also understanding where he's coming from on certain ideas or why something. That's something that Scott and Morris encouraged, and not at the cost of paying attention to theme, pattern, rhetoric, symbolism, irony, imagery. You know, Scott and Morris taught that those things were very important in our reading of the text, as does indeed MacDonald, and MacDonald employs those things to an incredibly deep degree. But that they are also all interested in a text as a, to be anachronistic and pull in Tolkien, an act of subcreation. And so that it is something that comes from a human. And so where, yes, your first reading, perhaps you dive into all those, you know, perhaps first reading, you enjoy the story. The next, you dive into the symbolism and imagery and topology, etc. But if we actually want to keep on diving deeper into a text and understand it better and better, that we'd be fools not to consider the person from who has spoken this text into existence, which again, you know, forgive me for saying, yet again, comes back to them for a theological concept.
Yeah. To follow that on a little bit, because one of the things that again just brings back maybe to Arnold a little bit, or the German philosopher Schleiermacher, who talks quite a bit about the critic as understanding the work better than the author. I think that's where I don't think MacDonald would go that far. And there's a sense in which what exactly, or where, what is that role? What is the relationship? So you're talking about it, a friendship. What is the relationship between the author and the reader, or the author and the critic? And again, there was a real sense in the 19th century, and I think into the 20th century, and maybe it's only recently, or even if at all, that's faded a bit with postmodernism, or at least loosens its hold slightly, that the critic actually controls the text more than the author does. Because that's basically what Schleiermacher and a lot of these German critics were saying, is we can say what this text means better than the person who wrote it.
And that's like me saying to you, I, Danny, can tell you who you are better than you can.
Yeah.
So there's, in a sense, a truth that for sure, there are things about you I might see and understand that you don't.
Yeah.
But there are obviously things that you know and see and understand that I don't. And I think this comes back to the relationality again, and how important relationship is to all of this, and the calling upon the voices of the past as part of this community. The reader and the writer of the text are in communication with each other. But all these early teachers of literature would say, that's why we need community, because we need not just one reader of the text. We need two, three, four, five readers of the text. And we will have a more true reading if we engage with something as a community rather than, say, Vane in Lilith, who is a deep reader of text but has no community, or Stoddart in the Seaboard Parish, who is not in communication with, or not in community with others, and therefore is not a good reader. So he can know the text really deep and well, but he does not know the text better than the author, simply because he approaches it as one person, as just himself, not even really in community with the author in that sense. But if you enter a relationship with other readers as a community of readers, which is a novel concept, really, I mean, really, it's the Victorian era where reading stops becoming a community endeavor, right? That's the era where that's starting to peter out, and we become solitary readers. And I think these early literature professors, teachers, critics, maybe they're even more aware of that, but they're certainly calling us into community, into a sense of community of response to a tech, not just with the writer, but I think also reading in community. And I think that's where we can forfend that which you were describing earlier. And what do you guys think of that?
I mean, I guess I see it. I would say I think that it is, relationship is a great term for it. And because it seems like there's always this push and pull between the reader and the author. And, you know, when it goes too far, when the author has too much power, it, you know, becomes authority, becomes kind of restricting to the reader kind of experience. And then if the reader goes too far and takes too much control of that situation, it sort of has the same sort of thing where the reader can kind of dictate whatever it is that they see or feel in the text. But there has to be some sort of relationship. There has to be an interplay between the two if you go to a text too servilely, if you're just sort of like, whatever the author says, that's true. I think that has lots of issues as well. And I see in McDonald that sort of openness to trying to tell the reader, take some responsibility.
Yes.
You know, and if you find something great, I don't care as the author. That's great. And also, I think that's based in this idea of God as. God is in that process. Like there's a like I think McDonald had a real sense of faith in reading as in all forms as a kind of almost divine activity. There's something going on in his sort of concept of interpretation itself, not of the Bible, although also of the Bible, but in all texts that something is going on there, and that God is using that moment in some sense to educate you to purify or. Knock something out of you that shouldn't be there, kind of thing.
And I think, I mean, and that was his approach as a teacher as well, in terms of, he says repeatedly, you know, he talks about kind of, oh, this is the key to Shakespeare, but but then he says, you know, I'm giving you this to understand so you can go away and do your own interpretation of it. So that was very much something that he communicated to his audience or his readers or whatever, was that mentality of, like you were saying, Danny, like kind of empowering them to, giving them the tools that they needed so that they could go be independent and not be dependent on him for, you know, an interpretation of a play or a poem or
perhaps
something.
Perhaps the most concrete manifestation of that is his Diary of an Old Soul when it is published, and the blank page, the white page, which is, you know, he makes very clear he's intentionally has that blank page across from the page with his text as an invitation to the reader to participate with his own response to the ideas that he's thinking upon, occurred by reflections on writings of others and of God. And he's inviting the reader into our participative reading and engagement.
And interestingly, it just made me think of the Hamlet is fairly similar. There's, you know, because they are interleaved, you know, that you've got the Hamlet on the one side and there's notes, and sometimes the notes fill the entire other side, but sometimes there's only a few notes and then there's like a large blank page on the other side. And I don't think he actually comments on that, but there kind of is an encouragement to note.
Like he did in other texts.
That's what he did, isn't it? Kind of writing all over.
You know, and from a personal perspective, I love a nice large margin because that's a sort of space for me. Whereas where they crowd it out, I'm like, oh, where's my space in this text?
Excellent.
But maybe as we sort of come to a conclusion here, what would you say? So taking McDonald's ideas about reading and criticism and the role of our role within that textual meaning exchange, what have you learned from McDonald? How do you go about, how has that changed? Has it changed your way, or is it just confirmed what you already sort of thought about reading? Has it changed the way that you read or the way that you do literary criticism? Any thoughts on its impact upon you?
I hope that I am a much more humble critic than I used to be. And it was really first reading how Morris laid that out, and then how McDonald follows up this awareness that these are people who've written these texts. whether they are alive or dead, and my engaging with them more hospitably, more humbly as a critic. I think that I really have been changed in that, I'd say, over. And I certainly have been deeply shaped by McDonald's call to see the good in a writer with whom I disagree muchly, and to look for the areas, because there's going to be nobody with whom I disagree 100%, nor anybody with whom I agree 100%. And I think he's definitely made me a better reader by, especially his talking on and on about Dante in particular, but Milton and others, that I disagree with them deeply in these areas. But this is so beautiful. This is so amazing. And let me call your attention to these good things. And that's how I want to be as a critic, as a teacher, and as a person. And that has shaped me for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think similarly, I hope that it will make me, it reminds me at least, to be a more generous reader. I think that's one of the nice things about working on McDonald, is when you're reading him, it's difficult not to then be influenced by what you're reading. So I found that actually to be a very good thing for me. And I think also he really, just the enjoyment of the text and how beautiful it is, and listen to what it sounds like, and you know, have you heard anything like this before, and drawing attention to just the beauty and the enjoyment of it. And I think that's something that can be so easy, especially if you're doing academic, you know,
to lose
or to like kind of feel a little bit embarrassed about, you know,
which he is not at all.
Yeah. Just really kind of, that isn't mutually exclusive, as we were saying near the beginning, with being critical about or evaluating something, but just enjoy if you keep enjoying it.
Yeah.
I think you do better work that way anyway.
Yeah. And then you are in more sympathy with the author then too.
Yes,
by
of
doing
course.
That.
Yeah.
And this realization that being positive and enjoying something doesn't impede our critical ability, but actually might make us better critics.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a novel
and
concept.
That,
shouldn't be.
And if that's primary, then then the criticism, or you know, the negative thing, actually is easier to receive, but also probably a little bit more accurate. I guess whenever you sort of read criticism that's almost purely negative, there's a slight sense of, why are you even writing this?
Exactly. They would say. There's like, that isn't why you do criticism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, who are you writing this for? You're writing, I guess it's for me that the other thing about what McDonald has done for me is made me a freer, more confident reader. There's a sense in which I think there was a little bit of I had more anxiety about getting the right thing when I read, and there was this sense of, I like particularly Fantasties. Like Fantasties was, I feel like, is a training in reading, and it's sort of, the first time I read it, I was just baffled, and like you know wanted to go. And probably part of the reason why I did a PhD on some level was because McDonald and not just McDonald, but all these people are confusing, right? And you sort of, this sense of, what does it mean? And I want to know what it means. And it's kind of what he's talking about there, that kind of trying to grasp things and get them, and then if I get them, oh, I can forget about it. And there's this sense of never feeling like you get it fully, and always sort of holding your readings lightly. And if you and then I think as a critic that also helps you a lot too, because if you're holding your reading lightly, you don't sort of feel this need to defend it to the death against all comers.
And you
right?
might even change your mind when talking to your step uncle.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, like McDonald did.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's that possibility, which is actually much more enjoyable, changing your mind on something in many ways, than fighting people every day to sort of keep your place in the world or whatever it happens to be. Well, anyway, we've got a train to catch, so we need to go. So I'd like to thank our first two guests, Amanda and Kirsten, for a lovely conversation.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll have them back sometime soon.
Yeah.